there were other things that bothered me. Perhaps it's retrospect, you know, I'm seeing them better now. But I think I was troubled, too, at the time by the fact that my church would keep changing rules. I mean, they change a rule anytime they wanted. This law is eternal, except for this weekend.
Special dispensation.
Magic words. Yeah, like eating meat on Friday was definitely a sin. Except for the people in Philadelphia. They were number one in the scrap iron drive. Yeah. They would give it away as a prize, you know. If your parish gave the most money to the Bishop's Relief Fund, hamburgers on Friday. Yeah. Well, and of course, I've been gone a long time now. It's not even a sin anymore to eat meat on Friday. But I'll bet you there are still some guys in hell doing time on a meat wrap, right? Gotta be there, yeah. I thought it was retroactive. I had a bologna sandwich. This guy had a beef jerky, right? Tell him what you had. How'd you like to do eternity for a beef jerky? Yeah, because hell wasn't no 5 to 10, you know. Hell was later. Heaven, hell, purgatory, and limbo. Those were the four big places to go. Yeah. Heaven was the only one they showed you pictures of. Drawings, I assume they were drawings, right? Artist's conception of heaven. You'd find that in Treasure Chest, the comic book with Chuck White, the Catholic comic book. Yeah, Chuck White fan. Yeah, occasionally you'd see a picture of heaven. Heaven was always a lot of yellow and white light, a lot of vertical lines, a lot of clouds. Might have been clouds, might have been apartment buildings. You weren't really sure, you know. And a lot of tall angels. Did you ever notice that? Except for the cherubs, all the angels, real tall dudes, yeah. And all blonde. They had far too many blondes in heaven, as far as I was concerned, yeah. Hell, they never showed you any pictures of hell. Hell was real easy to understand. Hell was fire, and anyone can dig fire, right?
Yeah. Hey, hell is like burning 100 Christmas trees and jumping right in the middle, you know?
Purgatory was weird. Purgatory was temporary hell. It was like it was as bad as hell, but you knew you were going home, man. Often wondered if they had, like, short time clubs in purgatory, you know? Little buttons. I'm short 2 eons, man. Yeah. I could do an eon standing on my head. Purgatory. The weirdest of all was limbo. Limbo was where they sent unbaptized babies. The reasoning was, it wasn't their fault. Yep, can't see God if you're not baptized, but you were too young to make the decision. Whip them into limbo! What could limbo have been, man? Welcome to limbo. I think they've since canceled limbo. I'm not completely sure, but I think when they purged a few of the saints, they called off limbo, too. Yeah. Hope they promoted everyone, sent them to heaven, you know, didn't just cut them loose in space, right? You know.
Thanks for returning to Great Speeches and Interviews on Axis Sacramento and The Voice. I'm Steve Lerman. We're listening to the Keystone XL Pipeline with Greg Dalton. The guests argue about the Canadian tar sands and the Keystone XL Pipeline.
We're talking about the Keystone Pipeline and oil sands here at Climate One. I'm Greg Dalton. We're going to invite your participation and put a microphone right here. And again, as Sarah said, if you are on this side of the house, please go around to our producer, Jane Ann, right there, and invite your participation with one brief one-part question, and I'm happy to help you keep it that way. Welcome you to let's have our audience question. Welcome to Climate One.
Good afternoon. Thank you very much for a fascinating discussion with so many good points of view. I have a question for all of you, including you, Greg. You mentioned that the State Department has prepared an environmental impact statement on the Keystone Pipeline. Has any of you read the Environmental Protection Agency's comments on this EIS? And if so, would you like to say a few words about that?
I read the letter recently. I'm not sure I understood it. They said the State Department didn't do enough, and then some of their assumptions were wrong, that the impacts could be greater. Who else would like to tackle that?
I agree.
Dan Miller?
I read a summary of it, and I agree. And I think they took a look at the argument that, hey, we're going to get it there one way or another, and this is not a valid argument. By the way, you know, you can justify anything bad, but you just say that. So but the EPA, it's really interesting to see that within our own government, there's different departments taking different stands on this.
And there's been some very cozy relationships between some of the contractors doing the work for the State Department who previously worked for TransCanada, the company building the pipeline. Let's have our next audience question.
I agree with the comment that the price of gasoline is about the same price of water. And I noticed a few years ago when the price of gasoline was a little bit over $5, people started seriously considering getting rid of their SUVs, maybe better land use planning, walking more, riding bicycles, things like that. And then once the price of gasoline dropped below $4, it was all people just stopped talking about it. So I've thought for a long time, although I wouldn't tell my friends this, that I think gasoline should be $10 a gallon, because that's the only way you're going to get people's attention about, you know, riding bicycles, having land use planning so you can walk to grocery stores, things like that. But, you know, how likely is it that we're going to get to $10 a gallon in this country or something near that? And even if we did, you know, the rest of the world could just say, fine, we're going to sell gas for $2 or $3 a gallon, and it really wouldn't help the overall carbon levels. So
Thank you.
I guess my question is, how likely is it we're going to get up to
$10 a
gallon? Well,
it is that. In Europe, it's already, you know, getting close to $10 a gallon. And they put out, the average European, I think, puts out half the CO2 that the average American does. And they actually have a very nice lifestyle for all the jokes we make about it here. But, you know, it's true that that's a great way. And a carbon price is a way to address that. Right? They actually just have gas taxes. They didn't do it for the carbon originally. But a carbon tax would raise the price, make alternatives cheaper. We would use less, get higher efficiency cars. We wouldn't need the pipeline because we would save far more fuel than the pipeline delivers.
But it'd take a big carbon price to get you up to $10 a gallon. A lot bigger than any of the carbon prices people are talking about right now.
And Cassie Doyle in Canada, gas prices are close to $10 a gallon. Do people drive smaller cars? How does that affect the vehicle sector contribution to greenhouse gases?
Well, our overall fleet is smaller and more efficient in Canada than it is in the United States. We have fewer cars per household and vehicle miles traveled. So I think it does make somewhat of a difference, but not as significant, I think, as these new CAFE standards. I think will have a much more impact on vehicle efficiency.
Cassie Doyle is Consul General of Canada in the United States, in San Francisco. Let's have our next question. Welcome.
Hi, this question might be for Dan or Sam. If the Obama administration approves the pipeline and expands the overall carbon fuel supply in the world, what impact might this have on the international climate negotiations and U.S. credibility, particularly in an attempt to influence China's development? Because they're the largest emitter now, and perhaps that's really substantial.
Sam Avery, thought on that?
I'm not certain how it will affect our national negotiating position on international agreements. I'm not certain about that. But if I can take your question and turn it a little bit, I would like to say that if the administration approves this pipeline and it begins construction, there's going to be a lot of people negotiating from a very grassroots position on this. Namely, at this point, 59,000 people have signed a pledge to resist this pipeline through civil disobedience if necessary. I am one of them. Many of us will be going to the root of this pipeline, and we will stand between the earth and the destruction of the earth. We will be civil. We will be peaceful. We do not mean to make TransCanada our enemy. We are not their enemy. They are not our enemy. We will be respectful of their employees and of their contractors. We will be respectful of the local people and the law enforcement people that we encounter. But we will be firm. You shall not pass. We are ready to lose this particular battle, but we will win the hearts and minds of humanity, and we will prevail.
But back to the government's position, we don't really have any credibility because we don't have any policy in place to to limit carbon. So how can we go to China and say, by the way, you really should cut back on your CO2 emissions because, you know, it really looks really bad. They're going to say, what are you talking about? Most of the CO2, the majority of the CO2 in the air is red, white, and blue, even though China is now currently putting more out than we do on a yearly basis. But remember, it lasts up there forever, so it's the total that matters. And so we have no credibility until we actually put a price on carbon. And then, by the way, if we just put a price on carbon, gave all the money back to citizens so everyone had money to pay for the higher fuel prices, and then put a border duty on products coming from other countries that don't have their own price on carbon, we would immediately get most of the world to have a price on carbon. So that's the way we can take a situation where we have no credibility to a situation where we can actually have effective and almost immediate impact on the situation.
Dan Miller is a clean tech investor. Let's have our next audience question in Climate One. Welcome.
Yes, you just said we will win the hearts and minds of people. And everyone knows that we need climate change. We need to help have climate change for the better. And yet everyone seems to be using logic. And logic doesn't reach the reptilian part of our brain.
Absolutely.
So when you said win the hearts and minds, and then Dan said before something about it's a moral issue, what if you change your arguments? Because if you only have 3 years, you have to do this fast. And reach people in a huge way, like the cigarette campaign, with the moral issue. I stopped smoking myself, but then you get people said, I don't have the right to harm you with my smoke. And if you try to accomplish the climate change that we need by a huge campaign of using the moral argument, I think you would reach people because there's something wrong with using perfectly good arguments and nobody changes. You are not doing it the right way, and what is the right way?
Sam Avery, you write about a person in your book that wants to make burning fossil fuels the equivalent of, or the pipeline of apartheid in South Africa.
Mm-hmm. Right. Well, I don't look at it that way myself, personally. I don't look at people who are producing and making fossil fuels available for us. They're not evil. They're producing what we demand. They're selling only what we buy. And so it's not a question of us versus them. This is not good guys and bad guys. We're all in the same boat here. And the big question we have to keep ourselves on here today and in general is, do we extract yet more fossil fuel? Do we keep going in this direction? Do we invest billions and billions of dollars in infrastructure that'll bring us more fossil fuel? Or do we invest billions of dollars in renewable energy, which will also produce jobs, which will also produce investment opportunities, which will also bring energy into our system? So it's a question of what kind of world are we going to start to build right now? One we can live in, or one we're going to make an immediate profit from?
Sam Avery is the author of The Pipeline and the Paradigm. Let's have our next question here at Climate One.
And I'll make this a very fast question. If this tar sands in Alberta is so huge and profitable, aren't there other tar sand places they're going to be finding in the world? Think China?
Greg Croft, you're the geology and petroleum expert here. Greg Croft.
What you'll find, those are the two largest deposits in the world by far, are in Canada and in eastern Venezuela. They are similar in size. It depends on whose report you're going to look at. The next biggest area of heavy oil is around the upper end of the Persian Gulf in southeastern Iraq, Kuwait, neutral zone, northernmost Saudi Arabia. That's about 200 billion barrels, so about one-sixth of the size of either the Canadian or the Venezuelan heavy oil deposits. And, of course, we haven't even talked about the Venezuelan heavy oil deposits here, but they are also going to be developed at some point in likelihood and use the same technology as Canada.
You gest your mic there, Greg. Thanks. That'll help. We're talking about the oil sands and Keystone Pipeline. Let's have our next audience question.
Hi, thank you. My question is kind of about the economic influences of big business and corporations, since in America those entities do play a really big role in getting things accomplished. What do you see the role of big business in this debate as far as political or economic influences they could have to swing this one way or the other?
Dan, would like Greg Croft?
Oh, you've got big business on both sides. You've got big oil producers in Canada that includes subsidiaries of U.S. majors like Chevron, Shell, and Exxon, or Shell is a European major, Chevron and Exxon, that are in favor of the pipeline. You also have U.S. industrial interests that benefit from the delay of the pipeline because of this differential in price we've talked about. The cheapest oil in the world is in the upper U.S. Midwest, which is an area, big center of heavy industry. So if you're going to build your oil-consuming factory in Chicago right now, you get oil cheaper than if you build it in the Jebel Ali Free Zone in Dubai. your break, your, if you choose Dubai, the reason you'll do it is because Dubai has no income tax, but you will be paying less for oil in Chicago right now. So there are a bunch of industrial interests that benefit hugely from delaying the pipeline, and if we shift the oil onto rail, this will in particular benefit Burlington Northern Railroad and its single largest shareholder, Warren Buffett. So there's big industrial interests and very wealthy individuals on both sides of this argument.
So Sam Avery, any of those industrial interests secretly funding the activists trying to block the pipeline?
Well, I haven't got my check yet.
Can I just add
Cassie
something?
Doyle.
The large energy producers who are come from around the world that are active in the oil sands have formed a council to drive down the overall GHG emissions associated with oil
greenhouse
sands.
Greenhouse gas emissions.
Yes, greenhouse gas emissions. So there is an oil sands innovation alliance. And there certainly is a commitment and an understanding that to secure a social license for the export of that oil in North America, that is going to require a much more efficient way of processing it. So I think we should. There is a fair amount of activity and investment in technologies now to produce that oil in the cleanest way possible.
Because they realize all the opposition they're facing. Mm-hmm. Let's have our next audience question. Welcome.
Thank you. Thank you for the great panel. I wanted to ask something about the United States' national interest in this oil. We are a net exporter of refined products of oil by about 1 million gallons a day. We have increased our exports by a factor of 3 since 2006. We have been producing a lot more oil in this country. So your oil, that is to say the Keystone XL oil, will be exported. It will not be here like the Keystone 1 pipeline, which is refined in the Midwest. Mm-hmm. So the Alberta government expects to increase its production. This pipeline is 830,000 barrels per day to something between 4 and 6 million barrels a day. So we don't need this stuff. My question here is, how many more pipelines do you expect to be approved by the United States government? And in general, where do you expect this oil to go, and how will it get there?
Cassie Doyle?
Well, right now, the United States is importing about half of its oil and is consuming somewhere between 18 and 19 million barrels per day. So the State Department's recent report indicated that the oil coming in from the Keystone XL would be to displace current oil that's coming in from Venezuela and Mexico and some domestic, and it's all heavy. It's heavy displacing heavy oil. So the assumptions that this is going to be exported, I think, are unfounded. They certainly were not found in the State Department. There is this country still, even though there has been an increase in production of oil, is still importing relatively about half of the oil that's coming in. Much of it's coming in by tanker from the Middle East and from other countries in the Americas, and that is not subject to any kind of environmental review. So one of the things that you always have to be mindful of is just what's the playing field here.
Though some people have said that there was some disclosure by the companies building the pipeline to their investors that the oil would be exported because it gets a higher price, as we've heard. The oil price in the U.S. is lower than the international price. Mm-hmm. Those companies naturally want to sell their oil to where they can get the higher price, mm-hmm. Right? We got to wrap it up here. Let's have our last audience question. Yes, sir. Welcome.
Okay. I'd like to put a voice in for the electric car. I think it's the one thing that exists within our society today that is a solution for the world if, in fact, our population could get convinced to do it and use renewable energy in our electric plants. But I'm nevertheless a little bit depressed by the discussion today because I suspect I'm older than all of you. In fact, the decisions will be made by people that are not going to be affected by the reality of what's going to happen with the CO2. It's two or three generations down that may very well have their lives ruined in an irreparable way. And this message, I don't think, gets across particularly well on the part. Certainly economists don't talk about it particularly well, and I think our politicians they tend to have a memory that lasts for as long as their term exists. So that I think we have a serious problem, and I think it really is a moral problem, and I think we need more moral input in order to deal with it.
We have to wrap it up quickly, but who'd like to tackle that? I mean, Dan, you've talked about future generations.
Not three generations. Our current children are going to be alive in 2030, 2050, 2060. This decade will be an exciting one. There's a Chinese curse, may you live in interesting times. Well, now we live in interesting times. And so, and by the way, I think there's some good news in that we're beginning to wake up. Hurricane Sandy helped us do it. The drought is helping us do it. There's going to be a lot of that happening this decade, and people are now aware. It's not like just doesn't seem random anymore. So hopefully we'll actually take some steps, and there are some easy steps we can take right away that would have big impacts, help the economy, spur innovation and investment, and or we could just keep doing what we're doing, I guess.
But there are a couple of important precedents on dealing with these long-term problems that I would point to. One is the global test ban on atmospheric nuclear testing. That's an example of a very long-term problem. It was a serious global problem. We increased the background radiation in the entire world doing it. And there seems to be a fairly effective treaty that, even people like North Korea, when they detonate a bomb, they do it underground now. So we have had an effect. Another one I would point to is the degradation of the ozone layer, the restrictions on chlorofluorocarbon emissions. That was a significant long-term problem, and there has been major steps taken to address it.
We have to end it there. We've been discussing the Keystone XL pipeline and oil from Canada here at Climate One. Our guests have been Sam Avery, author of The Pipeline and the Paradigm, Greg Croft, lecturer at St. Mary's College of California, Cassie Doyle, Consul General for Canada in San Francisco, and Dan Miller, Managing Director at the Rota Group and Investment Group. I'm Greg Dalton. Thank you all for coming to Climate One today.
Tune in to great speeches and interviews from 6 to 8 p.m. on Sundays on Access Sacramento, or go to greatspeechesandinterviews.blogspot.com. See the big picture on financial, military, environmental crises, war and peace, the economy, and climate change are covered. And then there's music and humor. Challenge your thinking with great speeches and interviews from 6 to 8 p.m. on Sundays, or go to greatspeechesandinterviews.blogspot.com.
That's all, folks.